And probably the greatest and the main thing that we gain from fasting is taqwa. Of course, this taqwa, which translates into God consciousness, God awareness, or in other terms, it is also even known as the fear of God. This taqwa is the most important externally apparent and internally hidden result of fasting. In reality, one can say that because one is conscious of the presence of the Almighty Allah, taqwa results in that we do good and we hold ourselves back from sinning. And so the fasting increases our taqwa, of course, when we have a sincere intention and we fulfill all the conditions and requirements of the fasting, and not just the physical conditions of fasting, but the spiritual conditions of fasting. It is interesting, but fasting and this siyam is the soul worship, perhaps, which can go totally unnoticed and hidden from anyone. For example, prayers in Hajj, pilgrimage in Jihad, the religious struggle, the Islamic tax, the Zakat, and the Khums, all of these things can pretty much be seen by one person or the other. But fasting is such that only Allah knows that a person is fasting. So, dear friends, one other thing that we learn and we gain from fasting before we end the program is that someone who can for one whole month refrain from eating and drinking and the other things that we must refrain them ourselves from, and we find that for one whole month we can control ourselves as respects to chastity and modesty and these things, we realize that we are much more powerful than we can ever imagine. This is Dialogue, the Holy Month of Ramadan.
حبيب التائبين يا شهر الصائمين.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
محارب اتصال برب العالمين وروضات سناها تقيم الوحي فينا محارب اتصال برب العالمين وروضات سناها
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Mohammed. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the row over the Muslim headscarf in the southern Indian state of Karnataka and how it constitutes blatant violation of religious freedom. And we shall also look at the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party anti-Muslim agenda and hideous attempts to fan the flames of communalism.
In the world's largest democracy, young Muslim women are fighting the biggest and most decisive battle of their lives. The ban on wearing hijab in schools in a southern Indian state has become a new flashpoint in the battle over rights of religious minorities in India, sparking global outcry. While Muslim students have stood their ground and refused to cave in, radical Hindu groups backed by the state have been resorting to extreme repressive measures to enforce the diktat.
The southern Indian state of Karnataka, governed by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, has been rocked by protests in recent months over the ban on hijab in government-run schools. The controversy erupted last December at a girls' school in the city of Udupi when several hijab-clad Muslim students were denied entry into classrooms. The girls' students protested over what they believed was a violation of their right to religious freedom, guaranteed under Article 25 of the Indian Constitution. Since then, protests have spread to other cities in the southern Indian state, as well as the national capital, New Delhi, as more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on the Islamic headscarf under the pressure of radical hate-mongering Hindu groups. Stung by growing protests, the government in Karnataka last week ordered closure of high schools and colleges in the state, and the matter reached the region's high court. Muslim girl students filed a petition to question how their hijab was disturbing equality, integrity, and law and order, on the basis of which the state government had banned them from the school. The court referred the matter to a bigger bench as it involves constitutional questions of personal law.
I think that the courts have consistently, in the past as well, upheld religious freedoms, upheld what they believe is the, like I said, a standard essential religious practice. But I think that the difficulty that I personally am seeing in this particular debate is, I think that instead of handling the question sort of head on and saying that, well, it is not the job of the individual who is seeking the ban to explain why this is an essential religious practice. It is the job of the state to explain why it is curtailing the exercise of this freedom. And so what the Karnataka High Court has now done as an interim measure is to say that nobody can exercise any of their religious practices. And so in the interim, in order to uphold public order, the court has said that, well, you know, even Hindus can't wear shawls or Muslims, and therefore Muslim women can also not wear hijab. But I think what they are conflating is that, first of all, Hindus wearing shawls, you know, wearing saffron shawls, is not necessarily, at least from my understanding, a religious practice which they really felt the need to earlier exercise. I think it was a reaction to Muslim women wearing hijabs. So I think that by comparing the two of them and making them equal, the court may have made this a harder issue for itself to solve, because I think that the question is still very simple. The question is just, there are freedoms, and there are freedoms of equality, and then there are freedoms of religion. And unless there is an overwhelming public interest to curtail either of them, the courts must necessarily favor the right to exercise those freedoms.
Protests against what is being seen as a flagrant violation of religious freedom in the Democratic Republic of India have spread far and wide, causing Narendra Modi government in New Delhi a huge embarrassment. Amidst the chaos, a Muslim student from Karnataka has become a symbol of heroic fight against right-wing hooliganism and the BJP's government's anti-Muslim policies. Muskan Khan's viral video, in which she confronts a Hindu mob with thunderous chants of Allahu Akbar, has caught the imagination of well-meaning people across India and beyond.
On the cold, wintry morning of February the 8th, a young Muslim student, Muskan Khan, parked her bike outside her school in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. Wearing hijab as she scampered across the school grounds, a group of men sporting saffron scarves, clothing associated with right-wing Hindu groups, accosted her in an intimidating way. A viral video of the incident showed the mob heckling her and demanding that she take off her face and head coverings. They hollered Jai Shri Ram, a slogan of radical Hindu groups. In response, the brave girl, far from being intimidated, looked them in the eye and chanted Allahu Akbar while punching her fist in the air as a sign of protest. The video became viral on social media, provoking strong reactions from civil society, media, and Muslim groups in the country.
I think it's extremely brave. And I think that, you know, women individually have been fighting this fight, and this is across the board, I think, especially women from minority religious communities in India, they've been fighting this fight on individualized skin. And it started in Udupi much earlier, in December itself in Karnataka, because some of these rules are completely new. There seems to be no reason why an educational institution has really come up with this. When for 30 odd years, you know, of course there are school uniforms, and that's a whole other debate, but you know, large colleges do allow people to wear what they want to wear, subject to certain broad restrictions. So I think that this video of this girl confronting the vigilante, it's definitely extremely powerful. And I think that it opened up a lot of debates. It opened up older debates in India about really how hard it is for women across the to exercise their rights to feel enfranchised, to feel like they have a voice say in something that is happening very concretely to them. So I think definitely this is it's an important video, and it's an important memory for India to remember what women have faced on a basis to even be enforced something that is extremely basic and really universal at all.
The confrontation between the schoolgirl and the mob of Hindu zealots illustrates the religious divide in India under the Narendra Modi-led BJP government and increasing vulnerability of religious minorities. The viral video has inspired an online pain in India, Muslim women reasserting their religious identity. The hashtag Hijab is our right has been trending on Twitter, resonating with people across the world.
The controversy over hijab in India divided the nation among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. Politicians and activists associated with the Hindu national government at the center and states have gone out of their way to support the ban on women's headscarf. On the other hand, some opposition parties, civil society groups and Muslim organizations have announced what they see as the blatant breach of India's constitution and fundamental rights.
The right-wing government in Karnataka last week issued a letter in support of the school's ban on hijab. In a circular, it directed schools and colleges in the state to strictly enforce a uniform dress code. In response, one of the students filed a legal petition arguing that wearing the scarf was a fundamental right to religion guaranteed by the Indian Constitution. The court will now have to decide hijab constitutes an essential religious practice and whether the ban is warranted.
It's an individual right. So practicing a religious belief or practicing on their heads, it's a visual right. So rights has to be prevailed. That's a rights has been given to the students.
The opponents of the ban contend the issue, which pertains to freedom of conscience and free profession, practice and propagation of religion, enshrined in Article 25 of the institution. However, the government officials in Karnataka think otherwise.
In my college, when I joined it, they just told me that if you're wearing it, you can wear hijab. Make sure it matches your uniform. We did that. Why, if right now they have this question, why did they allow us to wear it? If they did not had a problem from this, why did they allow us at one time? That's, you know, and moreover, it is not promoting our religion. This is our way to our pride, our modesty. It's just a way of us showing us that is our, you know, this is written in our religion. That is supposed to cover us. This is our pride. We wear it as telling it's a pride that, okay, you know, we are wearing hijab, you too start wearing it. We are not promoting and provoking everyone to wear. We are just wearing it because it's in our religion.
Many political commentators see the hijab row as part of a sinister maneuver by the BJP government in New Delhi. Communal tensions at times when elections are underway to choose a new government in the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh. The northern instance is nearly 2,000 kilometers away from Karnataka. The hijab controversy is closely tied to the party's national electoral strategy. long banked Islamophobic populism to win state elections.
The fault lines between the majority Hindu and minority Muslim in the world's second most populous country have terrifyingly widened since the Hindu nationalist government came to power in 2014. The toxicity of hate and hostility to Muslims, who make up around 14% of the country's 1.4 billion population, threatens to tear apart the fabric of India's secular democracy. Latest row over observance of hijab, the Muslim headscarf, has to be seen in the context of state elections in Uttar Pradesh, the most populated and the most crucial state in the country, as well as next year's election in Karnataka. The frequent communal flare-ups in India in recent years have largely happened around election time and due to incitement from radical Hindu groups. Appealing to emotions of Hindu pride and invoking the imaginary fear of Islamic expansionism has won the right-wing BJP many state elections since 2014.
Over the last, about 7-8 years, we are increasingly seeing that conversations about religion, conversations about conservative political thoughts, etc., are taking the forefront more. I think 8-10 years back when we were growing up, I don't remember having this level of conversation continuously about religion, and I felt that there was definitely the idea of secularism was a very clear idea growing up, and it was very clear to us that the Indian constitution protected all religious freedoms. And I think now you're definitely seeing a shift in that. And I think that that's sort of across the board. That's across the board with whether there are elections happening, elections not happening. And I definitely think that that is something that we are seeing a lot. And I think it would be incorrect to say that this is happening to all religions, because it is not. And in fact, we were just looking up something that, there is, Sikhs are allowed to practice their religion.
Karnataka and South India and Uttar Pradesh and North India are tied by a convoluted umbilical cord, as both states are ruled by BJP. Karnataka has emerged as the new Hindutva laboratory in South India, while Uttar Pradesh has in recent years seen a rising number of anti-Muslim hate crimes. Experts say what happens in Karnataka is directly proportional to what happens in Uttar Pradesh and vice versa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Now, to have more insight, we're joined by Simi Pasha, an independent journalist from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, Simi. So as you know, the iron-fisted ban on hijab in schools in the southern Indian state of Karnataka has sparked global outcry. Do you think the ban makes mockery of the country's constitution?
Thank you so much for discussing this issue and speaking to me about it. As an Indian, it's actually deeply disturbing to witness the kind of scenes that we're seeing all over the country. It's not just down south now. There are several instances that have been reported in Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh as well, North Indian states and in central India. While the courts decide whether a ban on hijab is actually a violation of fundamental rights, in my opinion, it definitely is. It's contrary to the idea of freedom, constitutional right of freedom and equality. These are fundamental rights that the Constitution of India guarantees every citizen of the country. I beg your pardon. It's also a violation of cultural and educational rights. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution protects the rights of minorities, especially if these minority groups have their own separate culture or language or script. Article 29 of the Indian Constitution gives the minority group a right to preserve their culture and protects them by preventing the state from imposing an outside culture on them. So I think these articles, what we're seeing in Karnataka is a violation of these fundamental rights. in my opinion, what the courts will be examining is whether the wearing of hijab is an essential practice under Islam, because there are two other articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 25 and 26, that allow freedom to practice any religion. So, for example, you have Sikhs in our country, people who practice Sikhism. They wear turbans on their head and they carry a kirpan, which is a small knife which they carry on them. This is allowed by the Constitution. Similarly, the courts will be examining whether wearing a hijab is an essential religious practice.
So, Simi, it started with one school, and now more schools have moved to implement a similar ban on hijab in Karnataka. Why is this piece of clothing making authorities so agitated?
So this ban on hijab has actually just come out of nowhere. We've been a secular democracy for more than 70 years. Muslim women in India have been wearing burqas and hijabs for as long as we remember. There's really no real reason. There's no reason what, nobody knows what prompted that school in Udupi, the Kundapur PU college, to issue a circular saying that girls wearing hijab should not be allowed inside their schools. And, you know, on the 5th of February, which is 5 days before Uttar Pradesh went to polls, the state government issued an order saying that girls will not be allowed to wear hijabs because it's not part of their uniform. Now, interestingly, when the Karnataka state government issued this directive, it was imposing an already previous order that it had passed in 2013, which means almost from between 2013, when the rules were first passed, to 2022 now, almost 9 years that rule has not been implemented. 9 years later, and 5 years before Uttar Pradesh goes to polls, Karnataka decides to impose a ban on hijab, which according to it, it had passed in 2013. So the timing is really suspect, and it really makes one wonder what the motive behind this is. Interestingly, one little point I'd like to make. There's a video that surfaced of Bajrang Dal and Vishwa Hindu Parishad, right-wing groups, distributing saffron shawls to Hindu boys and asking them to protest against Muslim women who are wearing hijab. So there's that angle as well.
Some Muslim girl students have filed a petition challenging the unfair and unjust violations of their rights to religious freedom. Are courts independent enough to deliver justice?
Well, we do have utmost faith in our judicial system, and as an Indian Muslim and as a member of an Indian society, Indian democracy, one of the world's largest democracy, I do believe that our courts will ensure that our fundamental rights are not trampled upon.
A viral video of a young Muslim student confronting a mob of Hindu vigilantes has created an international stir. How would you describe her act of resistance?
So we saw a video of this 19-year-old girl, Muskan, who shouted Allahu Akbar when she was being heckled, chased, harassed, humiliated by a group of 40 to 50 boys with saffron scarves around their necks, chanting Jai Shri Ram. If you see that video, it's actually bone-chilling, because it's not just heckling and it's not just harassment on religious grounds. There's also, you know, there's a threat of sexual violence as well. For that lonely girl to walk down that road from her scooter that she had parked and she was walking inside school, it must have been a harrowing time. And for her to stand up and say Allahu Akbar, it's not just an act of resistance. I think it's an act of bravery. It's an act of courage. And in fact, in an interview to an Indian news organization, she said that for me, I said Allahu Akbar because it made me feel safe and it gave me courage. And as all Muslims, we call out to Allah when we feel unsafe or weak or under threat. And she said, that's exactly what I did.
So the hijab row has virtually divided the country among those who defend the ban and those who oppose it. What's the position of opposition parties in India on this issue?
So opposition parties usually don't speak out against persecution of Muslims because they are wary of losing Hindu votes. But in this instance, they've been surprisingly vocal. Rahul Gandhi, who leads the Congress Party, which is the principal opposition party in the country, has put out several tweets supporting the girls who are wearing their hijab, fighting for their rights. His sister Priyanka Gandhi, who's also one of the vice presidents of the party, has also put out a tweet on Twitter saying that you cannot trample upon the rights of girls to wear whatever clothing they want to wear, whatever article of clothing that they choose to wear. There are other opposition parties as well who are also speaking out But I think it's basically the Congress which has taken up the issue. The Trinamool Congress has also made some noise about it. But for once, it has come as a surprise to everyone that that opposition parties are actually standing up and speaking out against persecution of Muslim girls. Because in this instance, it's also the right-wing Hindutva groups are trying to deprive Muslim girls of their basic right to receive an education. Which is extremely worrying, because everybody knows if you educate a girl, you educate a future family, and to deprive Muslim girls an education is basically an attempt to push Muslims into an abyss of poverty, unemployment, and economic backwardness.
There you have it. Simi, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai slams the refusal to let hijab-clad girls inside schools in India as horrifying, urging the Indian government to end the marginalization of Muslim women. Asaduddin Owaisi, a senior Indian politician and lawmaker, hails the Muslim girl who bravely confronted a Hindu mob for her commitment to education and exercising her freedom of religion and choice. A Delhi University professor, Apurva Nand, says he is ashamed and outraged by the scenes in Karnataka where Muslim women are being forced to take off hijab, calls it against all norms of civility. Irene Akbar, a journalist and social media activist, notes that Islamophobes can't digest the idea of a religious and empowered Muslim woman, which is why they oppose hijab-clad girls seeking education. Former Jammu and Kashmir Chief Minister Omar Abdullah argues that individuals must be free to choose what to wear, adding that if BJP leaders can wear saffron robes, Muslim girls can also use hijab.
And that was our episode about the unchecked assault on religious freedom of Muslims in BJP-ruled India. We shall meet again next week.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. During this special level of fasting, if someone backbites, his or her fasting is nullified. This is different from general fasting in which mere drinking and eating may nullify it. In other words, since special fasting is higher in status than general one, its nullifiers are also stricter.
شنیدید یه خانومی اومد پیش پیغمبر، پیغمبر گفتش که تعارف کرد که بیشن غذا بخو.
You might have heard the story of a lady who came to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, and he invited her to eat something. She claimed to be fasting, but Prophet insisted that you are not fasting, so come and eat. Then the Prophet stated, you, by backbiting, have eaten the flesh of your brother in faith, so you are not fasting. Therefore, those who want to have special fasting must have control over all their body organs too. Still, there's a third level of fasting, which is called very special fasting. At this level, all the body organs besides the thought and heart are fasting. Very special fasting belongs to those people who are not after an iota of sin or even thinking about sin. The people at this level are fasting from the very depth of their heart and soul. This is the highest level of fasting. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech in this holy month of Ramadan, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism, says Amir Makul, writer, in an article published under the heading Palestinians in the Naqab Face New Threat from Zionist Far-Right Militia. Stay tuned for more. After months of deliberations involving the Zionist regime police, the Beersheba municipality, and the far-right Otzma Yehudit party, the Zionist regime recently saw the establishment of a Jewish militia bent on reclaiming the personal safety of the citizen. In the Zionist regime political lexicon, citizen is shorthand for Jewish Israeli. The newly formed militia is called Sayuret Barel, a nod to the Zionist regime Sayuret, or Special Forces, and to the Zionist sniper Barel Shamoli, who was fatally shot at the Gaza fence last summer. And this might only be the beginning, after the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett recently called on gun owners to arm themselves in the public. He said, "What is expected of you, Israeli citizens? Vigilance and responsibility. Whoever has a gun license, this is the time to carry a gun. We are also currently evaluating a larger framework to involve civilian volunteers who want to help and be of assistance." Unquote. The initiative dates back to October, when former Zionist regime police officer Almog Cohen announced plans to establish an armed militia to protect Jewish residents of the Naqab due to what he baselessly claimed was inadequate police governance in the southern region. A call was put out for the registration of police volunteers who, according to the Zionist regime's media, were to undergo special training in one of the three brigades, one specialized in firearms, another in surveillance and security, and the third in logistics. Cohen said the group was formed because of the loss of sovereignty of the state and the personal security of the citizenry. His comments echoed the words of Beersheba's mayor, who has said, "If the regime would not carry out its duties, municipal militias would be required to restore security in the Naqab desert." These developments come in the wake of a string of violent incidents in the Naqab, which have fueled frustration among residents who say authorities are not doing enough to keep them safe. Ostensibly aiming to aid law enforcement, Cohen previously formed the Negev Rescue Committee, a far-right group that opposes the Arab-Palestinian presence in the Naqab. Shortly after announcing the formation of Sayuret Barel, Cohen was asked whether he planned to take the law into his own hands, to which he responded, "We will not wait on any bureaucracy." The group was initially supported by the Zionist regime's police and municipal authorities, but after gaining attention in the media, the police withdrew their endorsement of the organization, saying that it would not be involved and did not attend the launch event that took place on March 20th, but officials have not said they will prevent the group's operation. Notably, the police attributed this move to the group's funding sources, saying that it was forbidden to crowdsource for such purposes. But on their website, members of the militia say they were establishing, with confirmation and collaboration of the police, the Barel's force named after Barel Shamoli. For its part, the Beersheba municipality criticized police for stating that the municipality had launched the group as a residential initiative made up of volunteers for the protection of personal safety, noting that police had offered the group both legitimacy and supervision. The question remains, why did Israeli regime police withdraw their support at the last possible moment
over the crowdfunding issue. According to a police spokesperson quoted in Haaretz, the decision came after it was clarified that crowdsourcing for such purposes is forbidden. The spokesperson continued, "The police welcome citizens wishing to volunteer as long as this takes place according to police procedures." The crowdfunding in this case was done through a non-profit group that also raised money for the funding of former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's trial. Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism. In 1980s, one of the most prominent such groups, the Hamas-Tiret, the Jewish Underground, carried out terrorist operations against Palestinian targets. In addition to attempting to assassinate Palestinian political figures, the Jewish Underground also plotted to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque. What distinguishes Sayeret Barrel from such groups is its air of respectability and official backing. The municipality and police were complicit in its formation, even if they no longer support the group today. Palestinian rights groups and Knesset members should launch an investigation into the role of police in particular. During the uprising across historic Palestine last May, lynch mobs and terrorists targeted Arab neighborhoods, crimes that are typically treated leniently by the Zionist regime's so-called justice system. But the attacks were not limited to the far-right fringe, as the Zionist regime forces described the uprising as a new front that must be defended against in future, with the possibility of more intense violence ahead. In the case of Sayeret Barrel, the group's funding came through a crowdsourced campaign, which as of mid-March had reportedly raised 110,000 shekels, equally $34,000 of its target of 1.4 million shekels. At the end of the day, the formation of Sayeret Barrel and the fact that it has received official backing at various times and in various ways indicates that it is not just the product of individual fancy. A sophisticated organization is targeting Palestinians in the Negev and across all of Palestine, and its leader has encouraged volunteers to be judge, jury, and executioner.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of Barakah and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this. In fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the Islamic Laws on Arabi English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker in the studio with us. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to Ramadan and according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course. Sheikh Javid, let me start off this episode with this question. Is it permissible for individuals to smoke in the month of Ramadan while they're fasting? What if a person is addicted?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to both Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Grand Ayatollah Sistani, smoking is not allowed as an obligatory precaution in the month of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, while fasting, we are talking about a person who is fasting during the day, of course, a person cannot smoke while fasting as an obligatory precaution. And it does not make any difference whether a person is addicted or not addicted. Addiction does not become a license for an individual to smoke, you know. When we say that, when the scholars actually say that it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution, obviously the fast becomes affected, the fast becomes wide again based on an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. A pregnant woman, Sheikh Javid, does not know whether fasting will harm the baby or not.
Does she have to fast, though?
Well, it depends on whether she fears or not, or does not, whether fasting is harmful for the baby or not, whether she's going to be affected by the fast, or whether fast is going to somehow make her health, you know, bad or not. So in that case, if it is feared that fasting might actually hamper her poor state of health, or maybe her, may cause her body to become weak, and as a result, the baby might get, you know, affected somehow, or maybe even fasting may lead to some kind of miscarriage. In some cases, you know, it has been reported that some the fasting might lead to miscarriage. If there's genuine fear that the fasting might have such negative effects on her, then it's not permissible to fast.
I see. Let me ask you a quick question before our break, and then, in fact, we'll have a longer question coming up.
Sure.
What is the Islamic law, Sheikh Javid, about breastfeeding women?
Breastfeeding, if there is fear of harm to her baby due to a decrease in the quantity of milk, or it's drying up caused by fasting, of course, she should break the fast, you know. She should not allow her, you know, her milk to, the quantity of her milk to get or to decrease. And for every day in this case, of course, she has to give one mud of foodstuff. That is a kind of fidya that is given by her. And of course, this I have said it time and again, that one mud of foodstuff is equal to 750 grams of food. And the food can be in the form of noodles, in the form of rice or flour or, you know, barley or bread or anything. So, and obviously when she does not observe fast, she has to give also the qadha of the missed fast. She should, you know, perform the qadha.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws related to fasting and Ramadan. Before the break, I asked you a question about the pregnant women and breastfeeding women, Sheikh Javid. Imagine this situation or scenario that a pregnant woman fasted while she was breastfeeding her baby. And when she delivered, the baby was found dead. So there was a miscarriage. Sure. From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she still fasted. All right?
Yeah.
So was her fasting, first of all, valid? And second, is she also liable to pay the blood money for the dead baby? And number three, what is the ruling in her case if she did not think that fasting would be harmful but later found it to be otherwise?
Well, according to what Ayatollah Khamenei, you know, says, if she fasted even after she had reasonable fears that fasting would be harmful to her or her baby, or for example, or she discovered later that fasting was harmful to herself or her baby, then her fast is invalid.
you know, because she had fear. Mm-hmm. And that fear, as I have said many times,
yes,
is sufficient for an individual to avoid fasting, because in that case, of course, fasting becomes haram when one has genuine fear that fasting might have a very, or maybe a relatively negative impact on her health. And in that case, of course, not only the fast becomes void, but she has to observe the qadha also. She has to perform the qadha. And when it comes to the liability of paying the blood money, you know, because that's also a very important question, whether she is liable to pay the blood money or not, it depends upon actually proving that her fasting caused the death of the fetus. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to be proved. And unless it's proved, of course, the woman or the mother is not liable for the blood money or for the, you know, for the, you call it, diya.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about the last question then? What is the ruling in her case if she did not think that fasting would be harmful, but later found it to be otherwise?
You know, if she did not think, of course, she had, you know, she was allowed according to Islamic Sharia. She was allowed. And obviously in that case, she has, you know, every reason to say that I was pretty confident, mm-hmm, that fasting would not, you know, would not affect my health. So she started fasting, and later she realized that fasting was harmful to her health.
Yes.
In that case, of course, there's no qadha, there's no kafara, and the fast she had performed or the fast she observed is valid.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And we leave you in Allah's care, especially in this blessed month of Ramadan. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.